Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by IDG, the Leadership Specialists. Each episode, we examine the behaviours, skills and attributes required to improve human performance through effective leadership. We discuss the latest thinking and issues affecting leadership from the classroom to the boardroom to provide tangible insights as we go beyond the clichés to prove that leaders are made, not born. This is the second part of our chat with record-breaking mountaineer Jake Mayer, talking about his most recent expedition and the leadership, business and personal lessons that can be learned from it. If you haven't already listened to part one, then you really should go back and listen to that first. Not just because we're talking about the expedition chronologically, but also because there are some really good insights into team dynamics, motivation, organisational culture and much more. So, to recap where we left off, Jake had set out to try and climb the third, first and fourth highest mountains in the world, one after the other. Starting with Mount Kanchenjunga, Jake and his team had gone through their acclimatisation both in terms of getting used to the altitude and each other. Unfortunately, as they approached the summit, the team charged with fixing the guide safety ropes went the wrong way and ran out of rope, resulting in the decision being made to call off the summit attempt and head back to base camp. We pick up with Jake talking about his reaction to the choice that was made.
What was interesting is that I was incredibly sanguine about that decision. And maybe that's because I've had experience of not summiting mountains before. But a number of other team members were utterly gutted, very disappointed about this. One of my colleagues, he was in tears, and so was having to sort of console him. Others were effing and blinding at the human error that led us. You know, and I've seen literal fist fights in mountains when people are falling out. So it's not just the danger of the rocks and the avalanche, you've got to, it could be that fist as well. And essentially for us, that was it. We came back down to the top camp. I actually continued all the way back down to base camp that same day. And it was disappointing. Would I prefer to have got there? Yes. But like I say, in accepting the challenge of climbing a mountain like that, you also have to accept that sometimes it doesn't work out.
That's a very interesting analogy in itself, isn't it? The idea that in a lot of leadership teams I've been in over the years, any kind of conflict or disagreement is considered to be unacceptable. There's this veneer of politeness that means that the fist fights don't happen. People just internalize the pain and go away and live with it and probably inflict it on their loved ones. That ability for people to actually express how they really feel, whilst it's not always going to be helpful, as you've indicated, is actually quite interesting in terms of what that does for the group's dynamic and the ability of people to be open and honest with each other. I'm quite intrigued by that.
And I wonder, Jake, to use your word, I wonder how many leaders are sanguine about failure.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it depends what the cost of failure is, isn't it? Now, of course, in the mountains, because you're almost comparing, you know, the two ends of the spectrum are dying and not dying, if you want to go extreme enough. Now, okay, obviously health and safety, but hopefully in a workplace it's not quite as extreme as that. But we do recognise that people stake their careers and their career progression on decisions, on targets, on KPIs, etc. There are expectations over what you should or must achieve. And that can be really tough, you know. And if you're in sales and you've got a sales target for the year, for 9 months of the year, you can be bullish about it and go, yeah, we're definitely going to hit it. You know, where's it going to come from? Oh, well, I hope we're going to win this. Hope is not a strategy. And then suddenly it can all go downhill very quickly at the end when the grim reality of the situation dawns on you. And that's why, again, I think it's so important that we remember the human beings in every job role, under every job title, however senior it is, however junior it is, however mundane or technically specialized a role might be. And we all have emotions. We all have natural human reactions to the circumstances around us. And coming back down either from the summit or in base camp afterwards, you know, I spent time with pretty much everybody on the team, not that it was my place to do so, just chatting one-on-one, how are you feeling, you know, about the experience. And again, I think giving people that space to share their thoughts willingly, cleanly and without judgment becomes really important. And so at that stage, I had made up my mind that because of where we were in the season, that was going to be my one chance to try and summit Kanchenjunga. And that if, regardless of how it turned out, afterwards I would then go straight to Everest for stage two. Whereas for the others, everybody else in the team was staying, well, was only looking at Kanchenjunga for that season. Mm. So they then had very binary choices over, well, do I stick around and hope that there's a second summit attempt, or do I cut my losses and, you know what, we gave it a good go, it's time to go home.
Yeah.
And it was pretty much a 50-50 split. So
really?
I mean, if the 10 of the team, who, not including me, five of them stayed on the mountain, five of them went home.
And why do you think they went home? Because that's the thing with... that's the thing with mountaineering is, you know, whereas in a lot of times in the work environment, if something doesn't work, you scrap the whole thing, or mm-hmm. someone will say, well, we didn't get any results from that, so we'll scrap that. But I know from marketing campaigns that quite a lot of the time, even though you might not get the end result that you were after, what you did during the campaign in order to build it is a massive learning process and has a lot of value. And you literally have that on a mountain because you literally have the path up to camp four. And you're not, you know, just because you then don't make the final step, you shouldn't just go, right, let's get rid of everything. You sort of go, okay, well, maybe we can wait and then do it again next time.
Yeah.
So what do you think made those five go away?
So I suspect a lack of patience for some of them. For others, it may have been very, very simple in that they just ran out of time.
Mm.
That for those who had to get back to jobs or family, that the time was ticking and they had return flights booked that which they weren't prepared to move, and they worried that if they stayed on the mountain, there was no guarantee if there would be a second summit push or when that second summit push would happen. In the end, it happened six days later, and all of them got to the top. Now, extremely tragically, one of them didn't come back down from that summit push. But that sense that, you know, for anybody who had stuck around, that the summit was there for the taking, because they learned from that experience. They were able to take the new route, the fixing team. They had enough rope and everyone was prepared for it. They were able to use the previous experience as that jumping off point, that launch pad, with the pros and cons and the mistakes and everything they'd learn.
Mm. And I know you are a very positive person, and generally always looking on the bright side of things, and it's a really annoying trait in a work colleague, but such so that when I'm not giving any games away here, but when you told me that you got a touch of frost nip on your fingers, I just assumed you'd lost your entire hand, knowing how positive you generally are. But how did you at any point think, well, if I don't get Kanchenjunga, I haven't done what I set out to do, so I may as well just quit the whole thing?
It was really interesting, because before the expedition, well, before I left on it, I had positioned Kanchenjunga as the main effort, which in a purist military term, the main effort is the element of the task or the mission which you absolutely must achieve.
Mm.
Must do that. If all else fails, you will achieve X. Okay. Anything else becomes tangential to it. And I did contemplate, well, I've called it the main effort. Does that mean I should remain committed to it and throw away the opportunity to go to Everest or not? Now, in the end, actually, it purely came down to the simplicity of weighing up the opportunity cost of both elements, that the permit for Everest was nearly three times the cost of, well, the Everest element of the expedition was nearly three times the cost of the Kanchenjunga bit of it, even though in the end I spent 4 days on Everest and 40 days on Kanchenjunga. So incredibly expensive. So then it became a value and investment piece, that I could stick around and see out Kanchenjunga, hopefully, but I'm then knowingly sacrificing a very significant investment I've made in the Everest opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that sort of with in good conscience. especially because it was sponsorship money and it was essentially, it was other people's money. I felt I've got to give it a good go. And on we go, stage two.
There's some really interesting lessons here, aren't there, about how wedded somebody is to a target outcome or number. Because when I was reading the stuff you were sending back about getting within a couple of hundred meters of the summit on Kanchenjunga, to me, that sounds like a pretty much of a win. If somebody said to me, I want you to bring in £10 million this month, and I brought in £9,750,000, I think I'd done pretty well. But in a lot of organizations, the number is sacrosanct.
Yeah.
You've either hit it or you haven't. Mm-hmm. And that binary kind of thinking, I think, causes us a lot of trouble. You know, when you think of all the things you learned and how you use that and how you might use that in future things, you probably used it on Everest, you know, those things are going to come back and become useful again. I'm not sure we always have value very clear in our minds.
Yeah. And I think also about the value of what you place on the different elements. Again, in climbing, it makes it seem as though it's summit or bust, and that actually the only reason you might go on one of these expeditions is for that half an hour you stand with the world at your feet. When I still love the journey. And so the most important thing is you come back safe. That is the only ultimate arbiter of success or otherwise. But I could feel proud about our achievements and also pleased about the 6 weeks I had on the mountain, which mostly I'd enjoyed. Certainly the experience I'd really enjoyed. I'd learned a lot about myself. It was fascinating to be in that part of the country, that part of the world. It was an amazing experience. It was a shame not to summit, but that was the cherry on the cake rather than the entire cake.
Yes, absolutely. And it is interesting, isn't it, that consideration of those things, that when we become too binary about success and failure, we rob ourselves of the joy that comes from the journey and the experience and the learning. Because if the purpose, as Edmund Hillary says, is not to conquer the mountain, but to conquer yourselves, you probably learn more about you from not making the summit than you would have done from easily doing it.
Always. You know, what do they say? Experience is a hard teacher because it gives the test first and the lesson afterwards. That is where the true value comes from. And again, if every time we did it, it worked, we wouldn't be stretching ourselves. And actually, when you're not achieving something, you recognize that you are at the limit of your capability. Or at least the intersection between capability and luck and circumstance. And that's really exciting because that's where development comes from, as we all know. It's where evolution comes from. The improvement does not come from people sitting in their comfort zone.
Absolutely not. That's why we have WD-40 and not WD-33. Other
lubricants are available.
But I'm not sure there are. I don't think I know anybody.
There was also that point where, because I'd made the decision in my head that I'd be going to Everest, I was now looking forwards. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about looking backwards, which might have been a lot easier for me given my circumstances and future options than it was for some other members of the team.
And you would. It seems to me as well that you were leading yourself very well. You knew yourself in that situation. You knew what was important to you. And by making that decision and by making it clear that what you were then intended to do, that was what you needed at that point. You needed that to happen in order to carry on with the rest of the expedition.
Yes, because I think that you, when things are going well, you tend to live in the moment. When things are going badly, it's very easy to focus on what hasn't worked. So having something exciting to look forward to, what's next on the horizon, that you are echeloning through into the next challenge, the next piece of the puzzle, the next day of your life, frankly, that becomes the focal point for your attention, your energy, your emotions, rather than if I had thought, I'm just going home. Of course, going home is amazing, but and again, going home safely is the ultimate arbiter of success. But that's when you can feel very down and very low. And I've had that experience on other mountains, and that's not a great place to be in, this sort of slight contradiction of I'm excited to now be leaving, but I'm still a bit disappointed about going home. So almost empty-handed, whereas it's still in play. Off we go.
Yeah. So off you went to Everest.
Off we went to Everest. And I had teamed up with a Norwegian female climber called Kristin Harila, who is an incredibly strong climber and was working with a very strong Sherpa called Lama. And they had practically run up and down Kanchenjunga. So I bolted myself on to her, and we got on incredibly well. Within the space of sort of 24 hours, we'd gone from hello, how do you do, to should we climb Everest together, which was amazing. But talk about some speed of first aid. It was brilliant and thoroughly enjoyed it. She'd climbed Everest from the south side three times previously. I'd climbed it from the north the first time and a long time ago, but never from the south. So
is there a big difference between the two?
There's a massive difference. They might as well be two completely different mountains that just happen to meet at the same point and at the same altitude. The north is very rocky, the south is very snowy. The south is the route of the 1953 expedition, which is the first one that we know got to the top. The north is the route of the expeditions in the 1920s, made famous or infamous by George Mallory and Sandy Irving. Yes, as I say, two different mountains that happen to converge at the same point. And so to have that experience of climbing through a region which I knew so well from the books, the magazines, the stories, the videos, the films, but had never seen from my own eyes, despite the fact I was Mr. Everest, was humbling. I use that word again. It was wonderful. And I think I went up there like a five-year-old going for their first journey to London and going on a train and a bus and a tube and it's just being slack-jawed at the incredible environment around me, but also feeling very privileged to be climbing alongside Kristin and Lama and my Sherpa Fursang, was magic. And we, as we arrived in base camp, we were looking at the weather forecast and think, crikey, we haven't got much of the season left. There's a good day coming up very shortly. If we're going to go, we've got to go right now. So we set off at about 8 o'clock at night, which is quite traditional for trying to summit Everest, with the idea that you're looking to summit as early in the morning as possible. Ideally, what teams do is they have a pretty good target time that's going to take them to get up the mountain, and then they will manage their departure time accordingly. So if you think you're going to be really quick, you might leave a little bit later, because actually there's no point summiting at 2 o'clock in the morning because you can't see anything. If you think you're going to take a long time, you may leave much earlier. But people who try and climb it without oxygen, of course, then you have the challenges of the cold. So they may chance it and go sort of in the early morning, so that actually spending more time climbing during the heat of the day. But often what happens is they then get down much later. So there are lots of sort of ways in which you might do that. We left at 8 p.m. And you just head out into the darkness. And we were using oxygen at this point. Of course, this is unfamiliar terrain. I'd seen it the afternoon before, but it's now pitch dark and your head torch is illuminating a patch of ground 10, 15 feet in front of you. And you can see a few head torches above you from people who are making their way up. And that sometimes gives a false sense of scale, because it's difficult to know exactly where they are unless you can see somebody silhouetted by a torch. But you're thinking, well, at least we're heading in the right direction, assuming I'm not following the blinking tail lights of an aeroplane. I remember very clearly thinking, because first thing was in front, thinking, I am really tired. I've only been going for a few minutes, and every step I take is painful, it's exhausting, it's tiring. And I was conscious that it was cold, I was conscious it was windy, I was conscious that we were possibly pushing our luck with the conditions. And that was exacerbated by the fact that when after an hour or so we started passing people who were coming down saying it's too cold, it's too windy, when you know, or we're not feeling well enough. And you're thinking, What do they know that we don't? Hmm. And going through my mind, legitimately, was thinking, do we call it? You know, do we say let's head back down, because I'm tired and it's only going to get worse the further I go, and go back down to the high camp and maybe try again tomorrow. And I had to sort of counter that with almost my mantra of this too shall pass, that every step you take gets you a step closer to the top. And yes, it is painful. Yes, it is exhausting, but you're not going to get there sitting on your ass in the snow. You know, sitting on your backside does not a summit make. You know, you've got to go. And I'm my own worst enemy of this in my day to day, of looking at my to-do list and thinking, oh, that's a very long to-do list, and procrastinating. Well, tackle the monkey, you know, just do something. Yeah. Just get going on it, get started. And so it was just a case of going, there is a finite number of steps ahead of me. And now there's a finite number n minus two, as you get closer and closer. And there were periods where we got stuck behind a couple of other climbers. And in some ways that was frustrating. In other ways, it was quite relieving, because then the pace really slowed down and it became more comfortable. And then we'd maybe push past them, or we'd naturally get a chance to go past them, and suddenly you were back up to Fasang pace, which was uncomfortably fast. Oh God. And then I felt like I was holding him back, and I kept on asking, are we making good time? Because I had no way of judging how we were doing against our target times or locations, and similarly everything was unfamiliar, so I didn't know how far to certain landmarks and what time we should be getting to certain landmarks. So there was a little bit of child in back of car. Are we there yet? You know, are we at the balcony? Are we at the South Summit? When, how long until we get there? And him sort of having to go, I think 2 hours. And then me saying, right, well, we'll get there by this time. And then when that time came and passed, thinking, well, we should be here. Yeah, we just kept on going. And at about 4 a.m., there was sort of a thin slither of light on the horizon. And it was just started getting light, and that was quite nice. And we started to hit the South Summit. We at that stage, we passed Kristin, or more to the point, Kristin and Lama passed us as they were on their way down. They'd summited at about 3 a.m. or 3:30. Because they've made such good time, but they'd summited completely in the dark, so their summit photo is just them sort of, you know, lit with their torches, with no view. And we kept going, and I think when we got to the South Summit, that was the point at which I thought, this is it. I think we've made it. There's always a point on a summit push when you're thinking the end is in sight. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was particularly special was then looking along the summit ridge, which is, again, an image that I've had seared in my mind for decades from the photographs, and perhaps more recently from the negative photographs of the queues along that summit ridge, especially from 2019. And thinking, we are the only people up here. We are the highest people in the world with our feet on terra firma at the moment. And again, that was a pretty special moment. And suddenly I forgot about all the pain and the uncomfortableness of the previous 8 hours. And that walk along, that climb along the summit ridge, I really enjoyed. It's amazing how your mind and mindset can bring warmth to your limbs and strength to your legs, you know, and it almost has a physiological effect. It was magical.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm doing my neuroscientist bit on this, but you know that everything we experience pretty much is what we tell ourselves we're experiencing in our heads. You know, there's only pain if you told your brain that there's pain. Now, if you haven't told it that, then it's not there. You know, okay, there's limits to anybody's endurance, etc. But direction of travel is so important. Now, if you feel like you're making progress, doesn't actually matter where you're starting from or how far you're going. Whereas if you have this weird expectation that you've got to get to here by then everything is just disappointment. It takes a lot, I think, to manage yourself in those situations, and it's so important to have that sense of progression. The next step.
And it comes back to probably one of my favorite sort of little sayings or metaphors or things, which is from Jim Collins's book Good to Great, and you probably discussed it on this podcast before, but is the Stockdale paradox, the Jane Stockdale paradox, of how did he survive the horrors of captivity for so many years in Vietnam. Mm. And he referred to it as retain faith that you will prevail despite the circumstances, whilst at the same time confronting the brutal facts of your reality. You know, you can't forget about where you are, you know, especially up a mountain, thereby danger and death, you know, comes, right? If you forget about it and get flippant and complacent about the environment and your oxygen and the ropes and the steepness. But you need that little burning ember inside you to say, you know, keep on going, keep on. You can do this. And as you say, Nigel, that the brain might only be 2% of our body mass, and yet actually it contributes so much more to our desire and our willingness and our ability to succeed or not. And as both of you know, I am not a gym goer. I do zero physical training for any of my trips, and people are always surprised by that. But I'm a huge believer that strength of mind can do incredible things.
It's far more important. I think we've kind of proved that over and over in all kinds of studies and in looking at ourselves in the mirror, I think, you know. But it's this thing about grit that you have mentioned before. You know, it's a mental toughness issue. Do you believe that you have what it takes? This is why self-confidence is so important in achievement, you know, because if you have a belief that you are going to get there, yes, it might be difficult, and yes, there will be setbacks, but you are going to get there because you are capable, you will prevail. It's massively significant.
Yeah.
And people with low self-esteem often tend to struggle with that because they don't believe enough in what they're capable of to push through. And it's why we need to do so much work to help people to feel strong in themselves, to feel confident in their own capabilities, to learn to trust themselves, not just because it'll make them feel better, but because it'll make them perform 10 times better.
And again, as leaders, you know, yes, we want to stretch our people. Yes, we want to set ambitious goals, but we have to ensure that our people they themselves instinctively believe that it is possible and that they can be capable, almost irregardless of what might actually happen. But when they set out on these journeys, you know, creating that compelling vision that it's a good place to get to and you can get there. Can is not the same as will, but you can do that. And as long as people start that journey with that sense of, all right, it's not necessarily going to be easy, but come on, let's do it. That is the strongest, you know, start out of the blocks, isn't it?
Yeah, that Duke of Wellington famous quote from the Battle of Waterloo, hard pounding this gentleman, let's see who shall pound longest. you know, if you just keep going, in the end, other people will give up before you do.
Yep. You know, it's a finite number of steps, even if you don't know how many. N minus one now.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, it would be very easy to sort of characterize it as Jake and Christian, you know, we were the superheroes. We weren't. I mean, we were on the coattails of the Sherpas, who were the real, so Fursang and Lama, who were the real heroes of this story. And, you know, without them, I'm not saying we couldn't have done it because we would have had other people as members of the team, but it just made it enjoyable. And actually seeing the relationship between Kristen and Lama, who they'd climbed a number of peaks together in a relatively short time. Every time she did a piece to camera, she would always refer to him as the greatest Sherpa in the world, the strongest Sherpa in the world, the best Sherpa in the world. She thought he was absolutely amazing, and he demonstrated to match. Whereas for me, with my relationship with Fursang, who I'd met, well, actually I met him at Camp 2 on the mountain. So we spent 2.5 days together. So that was about building a team of trust very quickly, him understanding, well, is Jake capable or not? Am I going to have to drag him up the mountain or not? Am I going to have to do a thing for him or not? And again, I take my hat off to him about almost being able to diagnose the nature of, let's face it, the client relationship, client-supplier relationship very quickly.
So as you always tell me, you know, obviously, and it's very obvious that the journey up the mountain is very, very much only half of the journey. And you were quite ill when you, as you came down as well. So how did you feel as you got to the bottom of, well, back to base camp, shall we say, and you were in such a bad way, yet you must have felt elated that you'd got to the top of Everest, yet still disappointed about Kanchenjunga as well. So how did you sort of recover from that?
So the success and the feelings of pride and success on Everest masked the disappointment from Kanchenjunga for quite a few days in quite a good way. And actually it only came back into sort of sharp relief when I then became aware several days later that the teams had gone back up to the mountain, but that was tinged with tinged quite significantly with sadness, because whilst I found out that all of the team had been successful in getting to the top, that not all of them had come back down. So again, that becomes a bit of an emotional roller coaster when you find out that kind of a story. When I got back down into base camp, it's in some ways it's a little bit like getting to the top of the mountain. You are filled with a myriad of emotions of relief, of exhaustion, of elation, the thought about what happens next, you know, how quickly can I get back to civilization, and thus back to the food I'd been craving, or, you know, the souvenirs I'd been imagining buying for the family, and inevitably then back home and seeing my family. And again, that was the ultimate definition of success, and that was the ultimate thing I was aiming for. But it still is part of the journey. And fortunately, one of the first people I saw as I sort of stumbled, quite literally, into base camp was the base camp doctor, who was an Iranian doctor, frightfully nice. And I knew I had cold damage to a number of my fingers, and I had searing pain in my ribs. And so being able to go to him and essentially just be checked out and been given a bit of an MOT was really important for my own sort of clarity of mind. You know, I survived it, but and I don't want to say only just, because there were some people who only just survived it pretty genuinely, and perhaps, let's say, not all of them came back down from the mountain. But I was in pain. I was in clip order. And as a result of that, I'd already made the decision that I wouldn't be doing stage three of the project, which is Lhotse. That it wasn't, there was no point. I'd already been to 7,800, 7,900 meters on Lhotse. I'd seen it. I'd been up close and personal. I didn't need to tag the summit. And frankly, I was in no shape to be tagging the summit with what turned out to be torn intercostal muscles between my ribs. Fortunately, it wasn't broken ribs or a punctured lung or anything like that. But I was pretty bruised and battered. And I think that's probably what I said in my text to you, bruised and battered, but pleased to be down. And it was then about sort of next stage. And I think to your question about how do I feel about Kanchenjunga, that there was then a third summit push another week later. So technically speaking, even when I got back to Kathmandu, there could have been an opportunity for me to then gone back to Kanchenjunga and possibly be involved in the third summit. But you know what? Spilt milk. It doesn't matter. And actually, that only really became apparent when I was already back in England. I was already back home. And so, you know, yes, I might have been sitting around having a melancholy moment, but I was sitting around with my children and with my family and with my wife.
I wonder if, as you look back on the expedition, you know, what's your sort of overarching feeling about it? And is there anything else that from the learning experience which you're really going to take from it?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I've been doing a lot of soul searching having got back, because especially the first 2 weeks, first few days is a bit of a roller coaster of excitement and just the novelty of being home. And then as you start to essentially slip into the day-to-day BAU, whether or not that's personally or professionally, of doing the school run and having to log on for that Monday morning 9 a.m. call and things like that, that it can sometimes feel quite bizarre reflecting back on this time last week I was here, or this time a month ago I was there. In fact, this time a month ago I was just getting back down to camp two after our summit, or 4 weeks ago after the summit push. And I think in reflection, I'm extremely proud and extremely proud of what I did. I'm extremely honored to have been part of the teams and to have worked with the people I worked with and the people that I met, of course, none of whom I'd ever known before that mountain. And, you know, I honestly hope I will see, you know, see many of them again in the mountains or wherever, and look forward to doing that. I'm incredibly thankful for the personal development opportunity, that chance to put myself in a challenging environment where I'm not under a microscope, as in I'm not being tested in the sense, I'm not being assessed by anyone other than myself, but I'm being challenged by something I've thrown myself into. And it comes back to that Ed Hillary quote, it's not the mountain we conquer, but ourselves. And okay, I didn't quite manage to achieve the things that I set out to achieve when I started, but I'm proud of what I did do and what we did do. And, you know, any opportunity to be in the mountains is always a privilege. And whilst for much of the expedition, I was looking forward to getting home and almost wishing it away, of course, the minute you get back home, you get itchy feet again. So the Atlas on the shelf is well thumbed. The globe behind me is still spinning, and the mountains are still calling.
I'll make sure Saskia doesn't hear that part of the podcast. But there's a lot to learn there, I think, Nigel, about personal development, about prioritising personal development as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think if you've got your head straight as a person, as a leader, the biggest test you ever have to pass is the test of believing in yourself and valuing what you've achieved, because we should be our own harshest critic. Mm. Otherwise, we're not trying hard enough, you know. We should be facing up to the challenge of conquering ourselves, not the mountain. Mountain's just a mountain. Mm. You're there every day. You know, you wake up with you. You go to bed with you. Mm. The mountain is just a place you visit. You know, there's the real battle is always in our heads. So I think the biggest thing any of us can ever learn is to trust ourselves and to believe in ourselves. That would be it for me.
Mm. Well, I think that's a great point in which to leave it. Thanks a lot for your time today, Jake, for coming in and telling us and sharing all of that with us. And Nigel, as ever, thanks for your contributions, and we'll see you next time. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the topics discussed today. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching Inspirational Development Group, or email us on info@inspirationaldg.com. If you would like to learn more about IDG and the work we do optimizing human performance through leadership development, you can find us at inspirationaldevelopment.com. Thanks for listening.